Right, please be seated. Good morning. This morning, calling the case 19 AP 1320, Elliott Bray versus State Farm Automotive or Automobile Insurance Company. Appearances, please. Good morning. All right, we have Justice Ann Walsh Bradley appearing by phone this morning. So occasionally you might hear me sort of look up into the distance as if, you know, hold on, we need to hear from Justice Bradley. So we'll all listen for that. But I have Mr. Hebel arguing the first 25 minutes, saving 5 minutes for rebuttal. And Mr. Curtis arguing 30 minutes. Okay, with that understanding, we're prepared to proceed. Mr. Hebel, please.
Thank you. Good morning, Chief Justice and fellow justices. May it please the court, my name is Andrew Hebel of the law firm of Boardman & Clark here in Madison. And I represent the petitioner State Farm in this automobile insurance coverage dispute. It is a privilege to be here with you this morning to present our case in person, particularly after the past year and a half. This case is about underinsured motor vehicle benefits, known as UIM benefits. In this case, the Court of Appeals held that UIM benefits must be extended to plaintiff Elliott Bray for the death of his father, Ryan Johnson, even though Ryan Johnson had no insurance himself, had no ability to make a UIM claim, the State Farm policy here was issued on a vehicle not involved in the accident to a separate household that Ryan Johnson did not live in, and Mr. Bray was not in the accident and suffered no bodily injury. In reaching this holding, the Court of Appeals invalidated a policy provision present in the vast majority of auto policies in Wisconsin, requiring that a person actually insured under the policy must have been injured for the policy to extend coverage. There is no dispute that no person insured under the policy here was injured. There is no dispute that the plain language of the policy would foreclose the UIM claim here. The Circuit Court enforced this long-standing provision in a straightforward and persuasive ruling. The Court of Appeals reversed, relying upon an incorrect reading of the Wisconsin statutes. In doing so, the Court of Appeals expanded UIM coverage in a significant and to circumstances where it was never contemplated by the legislature. The same argument that the Court of Appeals accepted in this case has been made in many other states. Nearly all of those states have rejected the argument. Importantly, those states have substantially identical statutes to Wisconsin's. The cases and statutes are summarized in our brief. The Court of Appeals did not consider those cases. Respectfully, I would ask this court to do so. If the Court of Appeals decision stands, Wisconsin will be left significantly out of step with the vast majority of states. This will make UIM insurance, currently an optional but highly beneficial coverage, more expensive, discouraging its purchase, and also discouraging insurers from writing it because of significant new underwriting uncertainty. That underwriting uncertainty is well addressed in the amicus filings filed in support of our position. This will have exactly the opposite effect that the statute intends. Fewer insurers will sell UIM coverage, and it will become more expensive such that fewer people will buy it. But setting aside the position of other states, there can be no real question that the Wisconsin legislature did not intend the interpretation adopted by the Court of Appeals and argued for by the plaintiff here. The statutory change that plaintiff relies on took place in 2009. The legislature provided substantial information regarding its intentions in making numerous statutory changes to insurance coverage at that time. However, there is absolutely no mention of an expansion of UIM coverage in the manner argued for by plaintiff here in any of the legislative history accompanying the enactment. The legislature was completely silent about such a change. As several courts in other jurisdictions have noted, particularly the Utah Supreme Court that is quoted in our briefing, legislative silence is completely inconsistent with the significant expansion of coverage argued for by plaintiff here and adopted by the Court of Appeals. Since the purpose of statutory interpretation is to discern the legislature's intent, the legislature's silence in the face of what would otherwise be a significant change in the law is a clear indication that the Court of Appeals was incorrect. Now, I've spent some time talking about legislative intent, and I understand from a textual standpoint I might be getting the cart a little before the horse, but I do think for the Court's purposes, it is very important to emphasize that the significant change accepted by the Court of Appeals is utterly unsupported by any legislative history whatsoever in circumstances where the legislature was otherwise very, very clear in broadcasting its intent with respect to all of the other insurance coverage changes that it made at the same time.
Counsel, I don't think we really need to try to divine legislative intent, which is, of course, extremely difficult to do because what one legislator might have intended in voting for or against something might be inconsistent with what another legislator intended to accomplish. But what I find very compelling is the statutory history. We had significant changes to the automobile insurance laws in 2009 under Governor Doyle's administration, which really expanded consumer rights, I think we could say summarily. And then in 2011, we had a different governor in office. Political winds shifted, so to speak, and there was significant amendments and really, I think, repealing of a lot of what had been enacted as part of Governor Doyle's 2009 state budget. So a more compelling argument to this justice, anyway, would focus on that statutory history rather than trying to divine the intent of legislators.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think that's a very important point. I think that the changes that took place in 2011, which undid the changes that were enacted in 2009, most importantly for purposes of this case, what happened in 2011 was that underinsured motor vehicle coverage, UIM coverage, had been mandatory from 2009 to 2011, and after 2011, it became an optional coverage. And when coverage is optional, the legislature offers insurance companies greater flexibility to contract in writing their policies and setting forth the terms and conditions of their policy. But I do think that that is a very, very important point, which is an important part of our briefing in this case. In particular, underinsured motor vehicle coverage is generally interpreted side by side with uninsured motor vehicle coverage. They both are first party policy benefits and in many ways have been interpreted in the case law and their statutes in tandem. Uninsured motor vehicle coverage is a mandatory coverage. When anyone buys auto insurance coverage in this case, in this state, they have to buy UM coverage as opposed to UIM coverage is what we're talking about here. And the legislature, when it changed UIM coverage from being mandatory to optional, kept UM coverage mandatory. And I think one of the most significant arguments in our favor here is that UM coverage specifically requires that an injured person for whom the claim is being made be insured under the policy. That's a mandatory coverage, and it specifically makes that connection. When the legislature made UIM coverage optional, it's absurd to reach the conclusion that that same type of flexibility and requirement would not be intended. So I think that that statutory history is absolutely critical. Most importantly, the change from a mandatory to an optional coverage, allowing insurers greater freedom to contract. I do want to talk about the text. I do think the text clearly supports our position. Plaintiff's argument focuses on the change of the word injured person to insured person in 2009. The argument is this: changing injured to insured means that insurers can no longer require an insured to be injured in order for there to be UIM coverage. Say that five times fast.
Can you say that again? I did not catch that. Just one time slow.
I
say that
can.
One time slow.
Changing injured to insured means that insurers can no longer require an insured to be injured in order for there to be UIM coverage. That is essentially the plaintiff's argument. As the court can obviously discern, we do not agree. The reading completely ignores the statutory context. In our view, the question is better framed when it focuses on whom the statute is referring to when it states insured person. Ryan Johnson, the decedent, or Elliot Bray? I think that's a fair question. The reason I think that is because the existence of any claims in this case depends entirely upon the injuries and death of Ryan Johnson, because there can be no claims at all but for his injuries and death in the first place. It is entirely appropriate to focus on him. And this is what is meant by requiring a nexus between injury and insured for there to be coverage. This is precisely the holding in the Ledman case, which, while it did not interpret the statute here, and we concede that point, it interpreted policy language that is substantially identical to the current language in the statute. It does not make sense to interpret the language in the policy in Ledman one way while interpreting the same language in this statute another way. Ledman supports the argument requiring a nexus between injured and insured. And if the statute is referring to Ryan Johnson, there is no dispute that he was not an insured person at the time of the accident. If the legislative intent is to protect insured persons, Ryan Johnson was not insured. He is not within the statute's gambit, and the statute should not be interpreted to extend coverage where it was not intended. Ryan Johnson was not an insured, while his injuries and death are the sole reason that any potential claim exists in the first place. Mm-hmm. This unambiguously resolves the issue in our favor, and that is directly responding just to plaintiff's interpretation of the change of injured to insured. But there's more to it. Statutory context is key in any case involving statutory interpretation. Respectfully, the Court of Appeals decision and the plaintiff's arguments did not consider context. The contextual arguments are compelling. First, the word insured is modified in the same phrase in the statute and requires that the person in question be seeking damages for bodily injury, death, sickness, or disease. Not damages arising from, but damages for those categories. In this case, the only person that suffered damages for bodily injury or death is Ryan Johnson, but he was not insured for those damages. Interpreting the whole phrase, as the court must do, rather than just looking at the word insured in isolation, supports our position that there must be a nexus between injury and insured. Indeed, as we said in our brief, accepting plaintiff's position would render that statutory language superfluous. And in any legislative interpretation, the interpretation that does not render language superfluous is the correct interpretation. Elliot Bray is not seeking to personally recover such damages because he suffered no bodily injury himself. His damages are for the loss of relationship of his father, his loss of society and companionship. Those are derivative damages. They exist only because Ryan Johnson passed away in the first place. And I want to raise an important point here. The estate of Ryan Johnson is a party to this appeal, but is pursuing no UIM claims under the policy in question. No one is making an argument that the estate, in whom survivorship damages are vested like conscious pain and suffering and medical expenses, has a claim. No one is arguing those damages, which clearly are damages for bodily injury, death, sickness, or disease, are recoverable because those survivorship damages belong to Ryan Johnson's estate and he was not insured for them. In sum, because all claims depend on Ryan Johnson's injuries and death, and because the statute specifically refers to protection for persons insured for bodily injury and death, the most reasonable reading of the statute is that a nexus is required between insured and injury.
Counsel, can you address the argument on the other side that underinsured motor vehicle definition was repealed from the statute, that it used to be the same as uninsured motorist coverage, and now that I'm specifically talking about 632.32 sub E, the repeal of that provision, and what that means, if anything, with respect to your argument.
I think that's a very good question, Your Honor. I think that's an important question. And this is what I was referring to a little bit earlier in response to Justice Bradley's question about statutory history. Uninsured motor vehicle coverage, UM coverage, specifically requires a connection between insured and injury, and it's a mandatory coverage. So I think the fact that it is a mandatory coverage is very significant. UIM coverage, because it is an optional coverage, gives insurers greater freedom to contract in writing their UIM coverage benefits. So I think that the fact that that same requirement is not present for UIM coverage but is present for UM coverage means that insurers are free to make that requirement or not. And I think that is the most reasoned way to address that issue, because UIM coverage is optional. I also want to talk briefly about Wisconsin law regarding liability limits. That case law has now been made uncertain by the Court of Appeals decision. Under existing case law, the liability insurance limit under any policy for any coverage, third-party liability, uninsured motor vehicle, and underinsured motor vehicle coverage, is always tied to the insured person who must be an insured. Is always tied to the injured person who must be an insured. Extensive case law has supported this interpretation of policies, and none of this case law has ever concluded that these holdings are inconsistent with any existing statutory provisions. What this means is that if Ryan Johnson had been insured, all claims arising from his injuries or death made under his policy are subject to the single per person limit available to him. Derivative claims made by others, such as for loss of society and companionship, like Elliot Brace here, are made under Ryan Johnson's policy and are subject to Ryan Johnson's limit, not a separate limit for that claimant. Elliot Brace does not get a separate policy limit for his claims had Ryan Johnson been insured, because Elliot Brace's damages arise solely from Ryan Johnson's injuries. The law holds that his claims are subject to Ryan Johnson's limit, but Ryan Johnson was not insured. Under the existing case law, if the injured person had no insurance and thus no policy limit available to him, other persons asserting derivative claims arising from those same injuries have no policy limit available to them either from which to claim a recovery. This is very well-established law. The Court of Appeals decision puts this law into question. Ryan Johnson has no policy limit available to him because he was uninsured, but if the Court of Appeals decision stands now, any person who has a household policy on a non-accident vehicle and could assert derivative claims arising from an uninsured relative's injuries will be able to assert those derivative claims against their household policy. That is, the injured but uninsured person will have no claims of their own to assert, but the insured relative can now assert derivative claims against a policy that, under the case law discussed, never before permitted it. This is a very significant change to the law. If the legislature had intended such a change, it would have said so. This raises an additional point. It has been suggested that, had Ryan Johnson lived, Elliot Bray would not be able to assert any claims. Only because Ryan Johnson passed away can he do so now. By itself, if this were true, this is an absurd result that militates against the Court of Appeals interpretation. But the reality is even more absurd than that. The thing is, in the present situation, had Ryan Johnson lived, we all agree he would have had no insured claims to assert. However, if Ryan Johnson had lived and Elliot Bray had derivative claims for the loss of society and companionship arising from his father's injuries, under the Court of Appeals interpretation, Elliot Bray would now be able to assert a UIM claim against State Farm for those derivative claims, while Ryan Johnson would have no UIM claim to make. The absurdity of this speaks for itself. Canons of statutory interpretation tell us that absurd results evince an incorrect interpretation. That this specific outcome is in fact an absurd one has been repeatedly acknowledged by the courts in other states in rejecting this interpretation. I want to briefly address a little bit of additional statutory context which informs the court's interpretation. When we interpret a statute, we interpret the statute in the context of surrounding closely related statutes. The notion that requiring a nexus between injury and insured in the UIM context is clearly contemplated by the statutes here. In particular, those statutes enacted in 2011 which by the legislature's own statements were intended to return UIM coverage to how it had applied before 2009, created two provisions that permitted anti-stacking of policies and permitted reducing clauses in UIM coverage. And those were two of the big changes in 2009, is that those types of provisions were prohibited. They are once again permitted under the 2011 changes. And those statutory provisions specifically state that UIM coverage is a coverage available for bodily injury or death suffered by a person for any motor vehicle with respect to which the person is insured. These surrounding statutes specifically contemplate making a requirement that an insured be injured for UIM coverage to extend. Ryan Johnson was not insured for UIM coverage on any motor vehicle policy, and certainly not the State Farm policy in question here. Consideration of this additional context makes clear that our interpretation is the most reasonable one. I was going to talk about the important distinction between UM and UIM coverage here, because I do think it is a really important point to make that there is that specific definition of UM coverage, and that's not present in UIM coverage. And I think I've already covered that to an extent by pointing out the optional nature of UIM coverage, and I think that is what justifies the distinction between the two. I don't even have my orange light on yet, so I'm worried about reserving for rebuttal right now, but I got through my argument a little bit more quickly, so I'll just, in reserving, say in conclusion, our position is consistent with the vast majority of states, the legislative history of the enactment, the statutory history of the enactment, the statutory text itself, when properly placed in context, and the absurd results that will flow from concluding otherwise. And with that, I'll reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you.
All right. Well, you do have remaining time, but if you feel that you've made it through your argument, and I don't see too many questions coming at you, but just so you know, you still had a little time left on your 25 minutes.
Okay.
But if you feel like you concluded it, we're not going to force you to stay up there and keep talking to us.
Very well. I'll conclude for now, and then depending on what Mr. Curtis say, I may have a few more things to say myself.
Yes.
Thank you.
You have 5 minutes on rebuttal. All right, Mr. Curtis.
Excuse me while I lower the position.
No problem.
Thank you. Chief Justice and Justices, may it please the Court, my name is James Curtis of the firm of Hale Skemp Hansen Skemp & Slyke in La Crosse. And I'm appearing today for the plaintiff appellants, Elliot Bray, and the estate of Ryan Johnson. We appreciate the opportunity to address the court this morning. We are asking this court to apply a plain meaning analysis to what the legislature actually did with these statutes in 2009 and 2011, not what it may have intended to do. The threshold question is the meaning of the statutory definition of, quote, underinsured motorist coverage at the time of this accident in 2015. The Court of Appeals properly concluded that this term is clear and unambiguous, that Elliot Bray meets the three conditions to qualify for UIM coverage under the statutory definition, and that he is entitled to such coverage under the undisputed facts here. The second main issue for the court, I submit, is the effect of the legislature's repeal of the definition of underinsured motor vehicle in 2011. That term required that the vehicle be involved in an accident with a person who has UIM coverage. And State Farm would have the court construe the statute as if the legislature had not repealed that definition in 2011, that the requirement that the vehicle be involved in an accident with a person who has UIM coverage was not really important or necessary for the statute, and that State Farm was free after the repeal in 2011 to reimpose that requirement even after the statute had been rejected and repealed by the legislature.
Counsel, if you're if the statute had not been repealed, and we still had that statutory language there, it's your position that you would not have a claim, is that right?
That's correct.
Okay.
Justice, it's our position that as of the 2009 enactment with the four definitions that we've set forth, that State Farm's limitation on coverage by requiring bodily injury sustained by an insured is probably enforceable. And you're correct, it's our position that the repeal of the statute in 2011 makes a real difference here.
How do you respond, counsel, to the argument that was made that the repeal was just, it went alongside with the underinsured motorist coverage being no longer mandatory?
Well, it's true that in 2011, UIM coverage was no longer mandatory, but it returned to the status of what I call an optional mandatory coverage. The statute continued to require insurance companies to provide notice to its insured of the availability of UIM coverage, along with a brief description of what it was. And if the insured decided to say yes and purchase the UIM coverage, which is what happened in this case, then UIM coverage is a part of the policy, and it must conform to the statutory requirements that were in effect, including the definition of underinsured motorist coverage, which remained in the statute from 2009 up to the present time. So to try to argue that it's just, well, all of a sudden it's just optional, so it no longer needs to comply with the statute, is incorrect. If the insured purchases the coverage, the case law makes clear that the coverage must comply with statutory requirements or it's deemed to be void and unenforceable.
How do you get around the statute's requirement under insured motorist coverage is for, quote, the protection of persons insured? And Mr. Johnson was not an insured.
But Elliot Bray is an insured. It's undisputed. It's stipulated, in effect, that Elliot Bray is an insured under the state.
But the insured must recover for damages for bodily injury, death, sickness, or disease. So are you saying that the loss of society and companionship from his dad, which resulted from the father's death, somehow was bodily injury for Mr. Bray?
No, Justice, but the statutory definition deals with it's for the protection of persons insured under that UIM coverage who are legally entitled to recover damages
for
bodily
injury.
That's correct.
So you're disconnecting the need for the person insured to be the person that suffers a bodily injury.
Well, I'm not disconnecting it, at least I take some issue with that term. And maybe I can best address your question by getting to the purpose of UIM coverage, as this court has recognized in the statutory definition. I mean, in this case, Elliot Bray lost his father in the motor vehicle accident. He's the person entitled to recover for wrongful death. He is making here a liability claim against the tortfeasor, and the tortfeasor's liability insurer, Century Insurance. And in making such a claim, clearly Elliot Bray doesn't need to be involved in the accident or to have suffered bodily injury. The Century liability policy affords coverage with limits of $100,000, but there's coverage issues, and Century takes the position that its limit is limited to $25,000. It's undisputed that Elliot Bray qualifies as an insured under his mother's State Farm policy with the UIM limits of $250,000. And really all parties to this appeal, including the amicus parties, have recognized this court's pronouncements on the purpose of UIM coverage. That purpose is to put the insured, Elliot Bray, in the same position he would have occupied had the tortfeasor's liability limits been the same as the UIM limits purchased from State Farm. So as applied here, the UIM coverage puts Elliot Bray in the same position as if the Century liability policy had limits of $250,000. And if that were true, Elliot would be entitled to recover from the tortfeasor and Century up to that amount, regardless of whether he was involved in the accident or sustained bodily injury. So the way it works is that the claimant makes claim against the liability insurance and makes a partial recovery, and then turns to his own UIM coverage to collect the balance of uncompensated damages subject to a reducing clause which reduces the State Farm UIM limit by amounts recovered from the tortfeasor. This is the result that plaintiff appellants seek in this case, and the outcome is entirely consistent with the purpose of UIM coverage as recognized by this court, and there is really nothing unreasonable, absurd, or offensive about that outcome, and it's entirely consistent with the statutory definition of underinsured motorist coverage.
Do you agree with counsel's statement that if Mr. Johnson had not died, Mr. Bray would have no claim?
If Mr. Johnson had survived, let's say...
That's right. If he had not died, would Mr. Bray have a claim? Right.
Yes. If Mr. Johnson had survived, and let's assume he had serious injuries but survived, his minor child, Elliot Bray, would have a derivative claim for loss of society, perhaps loss of economic support, in the common law. And we submit that since Elliot Bray qualifies as an insured under the State Farm policy, that the UIM coverage would be potentially available if the liability limits were exhausted and there were uncompensated damages.
Wow. Thank you.
Counsel, in your brief, you state that a plain meaning analysis is the starting point for statutory interpretation. I agree with you there. But then you go on to say it requires the court to put blinders on. I don't think that's quite accurate, because your argument, if we're looking at the underinsured motorist coverage definition in isolation, I think you've got a better argument. We have to look at it in the context of the surrounding statutes and the permissible provisions portion, sub 5, those provisions suggest that your interpretation is not correct. They use terminology of insurance coverage available for bodily injury or death suffered by a person. And for bodily injury or death suffered by a person, that's sub F and sub G. So contextually, how do you take account of those other provisions that suggest it isn't the person insured, it's the person injured who would receive coverage under the UIM definition?
Well, Justice, as you just indicated, the statutes refer to bodily injuries suffered by a person, not bodily injuries suffered by an insured. So there's a distinction there that's very important. Further, the statutes that you refer to in sub 5 don't deal with a person's qualification for coverage under the policy. They don't deal with the requirements of coverage as the term underinsured motorist coverage does do. What these provisions do in sub 5 is to dictate the amount of coverage that may be available to the person who qualifies, or to the person who has suffered the injury. So in other words, an anti-stacking provision which would limit the coverage to a single limit, a statute dealing with a person who is a pedestrian who's not using a motor vehicle and limiting the pedestrian to the highest single limit available. They have nothing to do with qualification for coverage and only have dealings with the amount of coverage that would be available.
Sure, but sub G in particular references underinsured motorist coverage. It is, again, very closely related to the definition that we are trying to interpret and called upon to interpret. You don't think those closely surrounding statutes lend any meaning to the provision that we're construing?
Well, when you say any meaning, I mean, certainly the court should consider those in the contextual analysis. But the point that I think we're trying to make is that the portion of the statute which determines who qualifies for coverage, for UIM coverage, is the definition of underinsured motorist coverage. And we think that the Court of Appeals properly found that statute to be clear and unambiguous, and that any person who meets three requirements qualifies for UIM coverage. First, that the person who makes the claim must be an insured under the UIM coverage. Second, that the person must be legally entitled to recover damages for bodily injury or death. And third, that the person must be legally entitled to recover from an owner or operator of an underinsured motor vehicle. That's the way the Court of Appeals interpreted the definition and found that Elliott Bray meets these three conditions or requirements of the statutory definition. And it also noted that there is no language in the statute which allows an insurer to limit the UIM coverage to insureds who themselves sustain bodily injury. And as support for that, there was citation to the Tramp case, which is cited in the materials and in the Court of Appeals decision.
Mr. Curtis, I would like to ask you to respond to something that Mr. Hebel put in his brief when he was talking about, as he characterized it, the absurd interpretation of the way that you're looking at the statute. And what he wrote in his brief is this: indeed, it would be an odd result for your client, Bray, to be able to recover under a wrongful death theory if the motorist who killed his father was underinsured, but not if the motorist was entirely uninsured. I'm hoping you can respond to that.
That deals with the repeal of the definition of underinsured motor vehicle in 2011. And what we have, Justice, is, again, as of 2009, as we've set forth in our briefs, in the context of a statutory analysis, really dating back to the 1960s. In 2009, the legislature, for the first time, adopted four definitions which are relevant and important here. Definitions of uninsured motorist coverage, underinsured motorist coverage, uninsured motor vehicle, and underinsured motor vehicle. And the two motor vehicle definitions included a requirement that the vehicle be involved in an accident with the person who has UM or UIM coverage. And we've conceded in our briefing, and as Justice Hagedorn asked, we've conceded that with those four definitions in play, it makes sense that the State Farm limitation is enforceable because State Farm limits UIM coverage to an insured who himself sustains bodily injury. And when the statute's required that for a UIM vehicle, that the vehicle be involved in an accident with a person who has UIM coverage, that necessarily implicates bodily injury to an insured. In 2011, the legislature did a number of things that are relevant to your question and the plain meaning analysis. And I think most importantly what it did was to repeal the definition of underinsured motor vehicle in its entirety, thereby removing the element and requirement that the vehicle be involved in an accident with the person who has UIM coverage. That provision was rejected and appealed by the legislature and was no longer a statutory recognition of that limitation of coverage on UIM. We also think it important that in 2011, although this was not referenced in our written brief, but something I noticed in preparation for today, the legislature in 2011 did analyze the statutory definition of uninsured motor vehicle. It amended that section to provide an exception for vehicles owned by a governmental unit. Now, that's not directly relevant to our case, but what it shows is that in 2011, the legislature carefully considered both vehicle definitions. It amended the definition of uninsured motor vehicle, retaining the requirement that that vehicle be involved in an accident with a person who has UM coverage, and it repealed in its entirety the definition of underinsured motor vehicle, thereby removing and rejecting the definition that had been in place that required that the underinsured vehicle be involved in an accident with the person who has UIM coverage. Now, that repeal...
I'm thinking Justice Ann Walsh Bradley may have a question.
Yes, thank you.
If you're done answering the question of Justice Kurofsky.
Please, yeah.
Okay. Justice Bradley?
Thank you. And certainly I didn't mean to interrupt you. I heard that pause and I thought that you were finished. I don't know why the Crist case just doesn't solve this case before us. Paragraph 22 of Crist says, if the decedent would have been barred from making a claim, the decedent's statutory beneficiary also would be barred. It seems to me here that all agree that if Johnson had survived, he wouldn't have a claim against State Farm UIM coverage. So under Crist, how can your client have a claim? It seems that that language is pretty clear in Crist. So we've had a lot of discussion about statutory history, maybe legislative intent, words of the statute, absurd results, but why doesn't Crist just handle this whole thing?
Crist does not answer the inquiry for a couple of reasons. Number one, Crist is not an insurance case. It is a potential wrongful death case. It deals with statutes of limitations and the discovery rule and how a statute of limitations that might accrue before the injured person actually dies applies after death and how the discovery rule enters into that and how it applies to a survivor or beneficiary after the death. It's not
counsel,
an insurance...
Counsel?
Yes.
Counsel, thank you. I understand what the issues were in Crist, but I also can read the text of the opinion, the majority opinion, and it states, as I said, you know, it states that, hey, this is a derivative claim, and if in this instance, Johnson, for purposes of our case, couldn't bring the claim, then his statutory beneficiary is also barred. So whether or not the court should have addressed that issue, whether or not that language should have been there, you might advance an argument, but it's there, it's the law, and it's the nature of a derivative claim. If the source of the claim can't bring it, you have nothing to derive from. So respond to that.
Well, I think, again, you have to distinguish between the ability to make a claim, either a statutory or a common law claim, and insurance coverage for that claim. What we had in Crist is, you know, no issue of insurance coverage. The question addressed in Crist is, if the injured party's claim is barred by time, how does that affect the surviving beneficiary's claim? And certainly if it's already barred, the surviving beneficiary's claim is barred as well. What we're dealing with in the present case is that if Ryan Johnson had not died, he would have a surviving claim. He would not have insurance coverage beyond the Century liability policy, but he would have a claim. And Elliot Bray would have a common law claim derivative from his father's injuries, and Elliot Bray qualifies as an insured under the State Farm policy and could seek UIM coverage if there were inadequate liability limits to cover the loss. So again, Justice, with all due respect, we don't think that the Crist case is at all dispositive here. It recognizes in paragraph 22 a basic point of law that if the decedent's claim is barred by time, the surviving beneficiary's claim may also be barred on that same ground. Beyond that, we don't think it's particularly pertinent to the issues before the court. Have I addressed that adequately, Justice Bradley?
Yes. I see it as a matter of scope or length. Clearly, Johnson would not have a claim against State Farm under UIM. I think that's uncontroverted by everyone. But you're saying that the claim need not, for derivative purposes, be brought, be focused on, be circumscribed by any particular insurance contract coverage, I guess. It's clear Johnson could not bring a claim against State Farm under UIM. And that's why I say it's a matter of lens in terms of how narrow you make the question. So thank you, counsel, for your comment.
Thank you, Justice. Yes. In our briefing, we have asked the court to consider its recent decision in Milwaukee District Council 48 versus Milwaukee County, where a plain meaning analysis was applied. The court in that case basically found the statutory text to be clear and unambiguous and would be enforced according to its terms, even though the outcome was rather clearly contrary to what the legislative body had in mind. The court assumed the legislature's intent was expressed in the clear statutory language and held that it would be improper to reach beyond the statutory text itself to consider the practical, political, or policy implications of the law or the extrinsic ramifications of the court's construction. The court's task here in this case is to apply the statutory text as written, and that endeavor, we believe, results in a conclusion that Elliott Bray qualifies for UIM coverage. In the context of statutory construction, this court has historically said that it seeks to determine and give effect to the intent of the legislature. And where the statutory text is clear, that text is the best indication of legislative intent. The court's role is to consider and apply the clear text to give it meaning. It's not the court's role to bail out the legislature when it has taken action that, in hindsight, appears to be contrary to what it may have sought to accomplish.
Counsel, as you acknowledge in your brief, the vast majority of other states who have looked at this issue and this sort of language have not ruled favorably toward your position. Do you think we should disregard all of those other states' interpretations?
Not disregard those interpretations, Justice, but to apply what the legislature in the state of Wisconsin did in 2011 when it repealed the definition of underinsured motor vehicle, thereby removing from the ambit of UIM coverage the requirement that the vehicle be involved in an accident with the person who has UIM coverage, and forbidding State Farm from reimposing that condition after the repeal in 2011 to require bodily injury sustained by an insured as an absolute condition before the insured can qualify for a UIM recovery.
Counsel, if I buy your argument, don't I have to read subsection 5G out of the statutes? I mean, it basically says it's available for bodily injury or death suffered by a person who is not using the motor vehicle at the time of the accident. And it's for any motor vehicle with which the person was insured. So it seems to me that Mr. Johnson would have to be an insured, which we all agree he is not, because he's the person who suffered bodily injury. I don't know how you square 5G with your argument.
Okay. And again, 5F and 5G are really not relevant to our undisputed facts, but this is similar to Justice Bradley's question earlier. I think that, again, the import of 5G and 5F is to dictate the amount or limits of coverage available to a person who qualifies for coverage. So it regulates stacking of multiple policy limits that the insured may qualify for, and it regulates a pedestrian who's not using a motor vehicle and is hit, and it regulates the amount they're entitled.
But it identifies a person, and it has to be the same person on both sides of the line, and that's what troubles me about it.
And I would try to make the point that It deals with bodily injury suffered by a person. It doesn't say bodily injury suffered by an insured or the insured. And the purpose of the subsection is merely to regulate the amount or limit of coverage, not who qualifies for the coverage under the definition of 4D, defining underinsured motorist coverage.
But 5G does say this is the uninsured motorist coverage is for any motor vehicle with respect to which the person is insured. And the person that is also referenced in exactly the same statute, the same sentence, is the person who suffered injury. So I think that 5G definitely talks about you have to be an insured and you have to have suffered an injury. And those two things have to reside in the same person in order to come within underinsured motorist coverage.
I guess I respectfully disagree as to the significance of 5G, again, because it applies with defining the limits of coverage rather than the qualification for coverage. The Court of Appeals...
Why would they be different? Why would they be different? Why wouldn't they all be read together in context? They're all about the same thing.
Because a person must first qualify for coverage by being under the 4D definition. The person must be an insured under the UIM coverage. They must be legally entitled to recover damages for bodily injury or death. And they must be a person legally entitled to recover from the operator of an underinsured motor vehicle. Once they qualify for coverage, which is what the Court of Appeals properly found in construing that statute, you go to 5F, 5G. There are other sections in 5 which right. define the amount of coverage that the insured person is legally entitled to qualify for.
What you're telling me is that Mr. Bray qualifies for coverage, but 5G has no bearing on what amount can be paid? Your argument is hard for me to follow.
And again, if I could try to clarify, 4D defines underinsured motorist coverage.
Right.
It's for the protection of persons insured under that coverage
right.
who are legally entitled to recover damages.
But for what?
For bodily injury
to
or
whom?
Death.
To whom? To whom? The statute is silent that you're relying on the to whom part, but certainly 5G is not silent on to whom the damages must occur. That's where I'm having trouble with your argument.
And I understand your difficulty, and I think the best distinguishing feature that I can make, which is apparently not wholly acceptable, Justice, with all due respect, is that you first have to qualify for coverage before you can determine the amount of coverage available. And 4D defines the qualifier of who qualifies for underinsured motorist coverage.
Right, but it doesn't say to whom. Injury to whom. And you're saying, well, it could be injury to anybody, right? It could be injury to absolutely anybody. Doesn't have to be an insured or really even a relative. It could be a next-door neighbor. I mean, the to whom is important because you buy underinsured motorists as first-party coverage, and it's first-party coverage for an injury that the first party has occurred to that first party, but the tortfeasor is not able to pay for it through the tortfeasor's insurance. I mean, that's why you buy UIM coverage, right?
That's right, and that's what Elliot Bray's mother did for the protection of her family, including her minor child. She purchased UIM coverage, which Elliot qualifies as an insured, and to the extent he may make a partial recovery against the tortfeasor and his liability carrier, it is Elliot as and insured under the State Farm policy who seeks to recover the balance of uncompensated damages for which a premium was paid.
Thank you, counsel.
And I see that my time is up.
Yep, that's okay. Mr. Hebel left you a little, so we're still good.
All right. Thank you very much.
Counsel, as you're grabbing your things and raising the podium, I have a question for you. This derivative claim and Chris' argument. And I just wanted to, if you could help explain for me how that relates to your statutory argument. In other words, is this a separate? I read your argument as using that as support for your textual argument, that it all works together. Are you arguing, or is there a reason to separate independent alternative grounds, like you could move to dismiss, you know, the claim because it's not a proper wrongful death claim in this context?
I think that the purpose for which we would rely on Crist is to argue that this claim that Elliot Bray is making is derived from Ryan Johnson's death, and that without Ryan Johnson's death, on whom we believe the focus should be, Elliot Bray has no ability to make a claim. I think that for us is the significance of Crist, is that Crist holds that a wrongful death claim of the type Elliot Bray is bringing is a derivative claim of someone else's injuries or death. I do think that Justice Bradley's point about Crist, though, does lend some additional insight here in terms of the information available to the legislature in considering statutory changes to UIM coverage. It's clear that if Ryan Johnson could not make a claim himself from a liability standpoint, obviously there can be no derivative claims arising from that. You can't have a derivative claim in the absence of a direct claim in the first place that the injured person could make.
So you're not, just to clarify, maybe you could, but you're not arguing that as a standalone claim, a standalone argument by itself. You're arguing that as background information to support your statutory argument.
That's exactly right, Justice. Yes. And I just want to quickly rebut Mr. Curtis. He stated that the purpose of statutory interpretation is not to determine what the legislature intended, but what it actually did. No. The purpose of statutory interpretation is to discern the legislature's intent. The question is just, how do we go about doing it? Wisconsin uses a plain meaning analysis. So we use a plain meaning analysis to discern the statutory, to determine the legislature's intent. And one of the things when we do that is we can consider the context of surrounding closely related statutes. And I think Justice Rogensack's point, reliance on 5G provides that essential context here because it clearly shows that the legislature contemplates that a UIM insurer can require in their policy an optional coverage, can require in their policy that there be a nexus between injury and insured. It is clearly contemplated by the legislature in a surrounding closely related statute that nexus can be imposed in an insurance policy. Quickly, the purpose of UIM coverage, Attorney Curtis talked about this court's prior case law. This court's prior case law talking about the purpose of UIM coverage clearly talks about UIM coverage extending in circumstances where the injured party is the insured under the policy and other parties who may be making claims aren't making them until the injured person is uninsured who has a claim to make in the first place. And so I think that is very important when the court considers the purpose of UIM coverage is that it has always been contemplated that the policy in question was issued to the injured person. I think the underwriting concerns are apparent. The extent to which insurers would now have to consider all of these different relatives who might make claims but are uninsured if Elliot Bray is allowed to make claims in this case would essentially make underwriting UIM coverage almost impossible because you would be unable to ascertain the potential risk of all of these other individuals who are not parties to the policy. And that, I think, supports our position that the result here was not intended. In conclusion, our position is consistent with the vast majority of states, the legislative and statutory history, the statutory text itself when placed in context, and the absurd results that will flow from concluding otherwise. This court should keep Wisconsin in step with the vast majority of other states and reverse the Court of Appeals decision. Doing so will create underwriting certainty for insurers, keep premiums low, incentivize writing UIM coverage, incentivize people to buy it, benefit Wisconsin citizens because they will be more inclined to purchase it. Therefore, we would respectfully ask that this court reverse the Court of Appeals decision and reinstate the Circuit Court's decision granting State Farm summary judgment and dismissing the claims against State Farm. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. Thank you to both of you. Good briefing, great presentations, interesting arguments. We appreciate you being okay. And we will now conclude this case, take a brief break, get ready for the next case. Safe travels.